All right,
well, here it is.
Bye, folks.
Interesting day. Okay, Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kauai Store.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Kauai Store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostilas. The store has authentic Kauai products including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai Store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
KKCR listens to you. If you'd like to make comments or provide feedback regarding our programming, or to suggest programming you'd like to hear, go to kkcr.org, click on the contact link, and take our listener survey. Or send us a letter at KKCR, P.O. Box 825, Hanalei, Hawaii 96714. Kauai Community Radio, listening to you.
KKCR's Waverider program will make a huge splash during our upcoming spring membership drive. For a donation of $175, a brief message about your business or event will surf the airwaves during every two-hour program throughout our 14-day fundraiser. The spring membership drive begins Thursday, May 12th and continues through Wednesday, May 25th. Early sign-up guarantees the most airtime for your donated dollars. Waverider forms are available on kkcr.org or call 826-7774 for more information. Reserve your spot in the lineup today.
And mahalo for listening to Kauai Community Radio, the station that loves you. We're going to have a really great show today. Bridget Hammerquist, who is our beloved from Friends of Mahalapu, that's an organization that just seems to never quit in terms of doing wonderful things for the community. I have to give her a big shout out because she is kind and filled with integrity and selfless. So I appreciate that. And their whole organization is very good at bringing really quality things to town and just caring about everybody. So what they've got for us today and really this week is we've got this guy, Paul Cienfuegos. He is a community rights ground worker, member, person who does all kinds of things all over the country. I went to the first of the events yesterday that was in Kapa'a, and it was really, really worth the time. There's five events at 6 o'clock, and tonight it will be at Kilauea Elementary School. So last night it was at Kapa'a Library, filled, overflowing. Tonight it's at Kilauea Elementary School in the cafeteria. Tomorrow night it's in Kalaheo, the neighborhood center. Thursday night it's in Kaloa at the neighborhood center. Everything is at 6 o'clock, and it will be recorded in Kaloa, and I'm sure it will end up on Hauike. But we are really looking forward to having them. And he was really very informative about how to reclaim the law for the citizens. Marshall, you're on.
All right. Aloha, Felicia.
Hi, Marshall. Thanks for helping. Let's just start for a moment with the primaries.
Okay. Well, today we had the West Virginia primary, and it's looking like Bernie Sanders has won with 50% of the vote. Hillary Clinton has garnered 39. I don't know what happened to the rest of the vote there. They lost it somewhere. And on the Republican side, the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party has gotten 75% of the vote
in
West Virginia.
That would be Donald Trump.
That would be him.
So they can't have counted everything by now, though. It just kind of closed, didn't it? How much percentage is reporting?
Stop spinning, computer, and I'll tell you in just a second.
Okay, and we're racing to the computer here. I'm seeing mine says 45% reporting.
Yeah, that's enough to get a good prediction.
Well, yeah, with a 12-point spread, that's significant. And when you said what happened to the rest, well, it's not like there aren't other people running. Gary Johnson is on the Libertarian ticket, and Jill Stein is on the Green Party ticket.
Well, right, but
so they might have gotten some of that.
But they aren't on the Democratic primary ticket.
Oh, right. Okay, thank you.
All right.
Up to speed. I knew that. So, thank you for that. And so I see that on the Republican primary, there is two today. There's Nebraska and West Virginia. So that is another 70 delegates, and
For the Democrats, those delegates have already been awarded.
I'm talking about the Republican.
Okay.
So it looks like we have a call coming in, and so let's go ahead and take that. Aloha, you are on the air. Nope. Okay. Maybe we'll try in just a second. So, Donald Trump, it's interesting, in Nebraska and West Virginia, the other candidates are still on there, but he got 75% in West Virginia, and then in Nebraska, he's showing 60%. So, we have a caller. Aloha, you're on the air. Hello? You're on the air. Is that button pushed?
Paul. It's Paul Cienfuegos.
Paul, are you there? We might have to go grab Dean and see what's up with the phones. We are getting ready for our fun drive, and we're in the process of redoing the studio and everything else. But Dean, our fearless manager's here. Paul, are you there?
Hello?
Hi. Okay, yes. We didn't even need Dean to be pulling you up. So, Paul, you're going to be in the studio in the flesh in just a moment, but we are really glad that you are already joining us on the phone. Kauai style, kind of just trying to get here. So are you hearing us fine?
I'm hearing you just fine. How about me?
Yes. So I was telling the listeners, how worthwhile was the meeting last night?
I thought them really well, and it was quite exciting energy last night. There were almost 40 people signed in at the door, and quite a few of them had some really good questions for the speakers.
Yes, and I'm not sure everybody signed in. The room was over capacity, so so that was very good. So I want to allow you to tell the listener just a little bit about your background and you know, when you get in here, I'm probably going to have a little bit more vigorous questions for you. But tell us who you are.
Well, I've been a grassroots community organizer and workshop leader for, 36, 37 years. And for the last 20 years or so, I've been working in the community rights movement, which is a grassroots kind of bottom-up movement of communities across the United States who are tired of waiting for our state and federal governments to protect the health and welfare of the people and of our local environments, and are pretty much taking their authority back to both govern themselves and to pass laws that protect their own health and welfare. The community rights movement and is what we call ourselves, and 200 communities in 9 states across the U.S. have passed these really extraordinary paradigm-shifting laws that each do 3 different things. Each local law does 3 different things that haven't been tried before in local lawmaking. They strip that sector of corporations that the community is challenging of all of their so-called corporate constitutional rights. They enshrine the inherent right of a community to govern itself, free from constraints by state and federal authority. And they ban a particular kind of corporate activity, be it mining, fracking, clear-cutting, GMO ag, factory farms, etc. I just want to make sure that you're still there and that I'm coming through.
Yes, you are. Thank you so much.
Great. And so I've been leading workshops across the United States for almost 20 years, and the movement has really picked up in the last couple of years. I've been just, for example, in the last 6 or 8 weeks, I've led workshops in Iowa, Wisconsin, North and South Carolina, and Northern California. So communities across the country, and this work works at the town, township, city, or county level. Communities are saying we're sick and tired of corporations pushing our communities around. We're sick and tired of the structures of law that exist in the United States not protecting us and protecting our health and welfare. And so lawmaking is starting to happen more and more at the local level. I think it's a really exciting movement.
I think it's really exciting. And what I really, really enjoyed hearing was that in, and I'm going to have you give some examples of the types of conflict that are coming up in the community so people know that it's not just like what we're dealing with here. Like one big issue that's being dealt with here is conflict over the pesticide usage. That's something very, very large. I know that Friends of Mahalapu have brought you here, and so some of that is over the really astounding concerns of what's happening with the dairy farms. But what your work is it's not about necessarily what the issue is, it's what the needs of a particular community. So could you give us a few examples of the types of conflicts that communities have had with external forces coming in to really use the resources of an area and that they have had success with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps one of the most interesting stories that's current across the United States right now is in Grant Township, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is the first state where this work took off starting in 1999. There's about 100 small communities and townships that have passed ordinances just in that one state. But a handful of years ago, Grant Township, Pennsylvania, attempted to pass a community rights ordinance. In fact, they did pass through the ballot box a community rights ordinance that banned companies from dumping the wastewater from fracking into basically they're depositing it in holes in the ground to make it go, quote, away, unquote.
Is this what's called injection wells?
Yes, these are injecting the wastewater into wells, yes.
So it goes back actually into the water table, hopefully below the water table.
Right, and the claim always is that it's not going to mix with the water, which is completely ridiculous. So the community passed an ordinance saying no wastewater deposit in Grant Township, Pennsylvania. The company that was doing it was a utility company in the area. It immediately sued Grant Township, Pennsylvania. And one of the really interesting things about this particular ordinance was that the township supervisors, the elected supervisors, were very keen on incorporating recognized and enforceable rights of nature into their lawmaking. And the part of nature that was going to be severely damaged by this dumping of wastewater into the ground was the Little Mahoning River, the Little Mahoning watershed. And as about a couple dozen of the 200 communities across the country have done in their local lawmaking, they included enforceable rights to the Little Mahoning River. And so they actually placed the Little Mahoning River's rights directly into the ordinance. And when the company sued the township, Grant Township, a couple of years ago, you know, our side did what we always do, which is we defend our ordinance through the courts, not necessarily expecting to win, but intending on developing kind of a new set of case law to start challenging corporate constitutional rights. That is happening, and the defense documents are really interesting to defend the township against the corporation. But what happened next is even more intriguing. The township decided to get a lot more proactive, and so while they're fighting the utility company through the courts, they then passed another ballot initiative that was the first ever home rule charter passed by a township in the United States. And it wasn't just any home rule charter, because home rule charters tend to be mostly about how you're structuring your local government governing authority. This home rule charter was a community rights home rule charter from top to bottom, and incorporated, again, rights of nation legislation directly into the ordinance. So you have, what's interesting is that even conservative communities in Pennsylvania have realized that when you incorporate rights of nature into your ordinances, which you certainly don't have to do, but they chose to do, it actually gives you more tools, more legal tools in your toolbox, because nature can now defend its own rights. And so property owners don't just have property rights over their land. Their land actually has its own rights that can be defended against corporate harms. So that's just one recent example that's happening.
So the conservatives were actually supportive of that? Like, I would see where the community rights movement would be probably more resonant with the conservatives. That would be my expectation, and progressives more on the rights of nature. But it sounds like maybe you have both conservative and progressives, and maybe even, you know, libertarian people are part of the support for these type. When you're telling me Pennsylvania, I'm thinking in that kind of direction.
Yeah. In fact, I would say of the approximately 30 of 200 communities that have passed these laws that have rights of nature clauses in them, most of them are rural conservative communities. And when I got involved in this movement some years ago, I was stunned to find that out, because as somebody who saw myself as more of a, you know, green progressive type voter, I was totally impressed that conservatives could understand that, recognizing that the nature on their own property having rights gave them another tool. And intriguingly, one of the strange things about this work that I love is that both left and right wing communities resonate with it really well, with different aspects of it, and it's totally up to each community to decide what they put in their community rights ordinance. And I just lost my train of thought. I was going to say,
Well,
hopefully I'll remember and you can ask me something
okay.
else.
Okay, and Paul Cienfuegos, I'm saying your name right, right? That's like 100 fires, Paul Cienfuegos. Is your organization called Community Rights Groundwork? I see that communityrightsgroundwork.org is your website.
Yes. My website for years and years has been my full name, Paul Cienfuegos, with a .com at the end. That's probably a better place at this point to look for information about my talks, workshops, weekly radio commentary, and podcast.
Well, I see that you're using...
Community Rights Groundwork is an organization that is just on the verge of going, of opening up officially. So the website's already up. You're welcome to look at it, but we're not quite official and open yet.
Because I'm hearing you use the word we, and so I like that word, by the way. I think it's a really important word. I know that you have done lots of work in different places. Can you give the listener a little bit of understanding of where you're from and then what brings you to all these different areas? Like, what causes people to call you and ask for help? You're from Oregon, right?
Well, I started my part of this work in Humboldt County, California, as the founding director of Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County. You can still find it. democracyunlimited.org. And from there, I went on to Portland about 5 years ago, and I co-founded Community Rights PDX. PDX is the airport shorthand for Portland, and a lot of local groups use it to represent Portland. So communityrightspdx.org is our local community rights group, and we're currently working on, hopefully in the very near future, launching a neighborhood Bill of Rights ballot initiative campaign that would give neighborhood majorities a lot more control over what kinds of corporate developments happen in their neighborhoods. And from there, I helped to co-found the Oregon Community Rights Network, which has about a half a dozen counties active in it. And in fact, there are now 6 active state community rights networks across the United States. Once enough of these local groups have passed ordinances at the local level, then they shift to state-level organizing and start challenging the rights of corporations under the state laws and state constitutions. So I've been in Portland now for about 5 years, and I lead workshops all over the United States, as I said. And the movement kind of, I think, primarily sees me as a spark, I'm very good at coming into a community that hasn't heard of community rights and building a level of excitement and basic ground-level understanding of community rights strategy.
And building
so that a group can form and get more training.
And build confidence. A couple of things that I felt were really super helpful last night at the Kapa event, and tonight, just for listeners who might have just started tuning in, 6 o'clock at Kilauea Elementary School Cafeteria, Paul Cienfuegos will be speaking. I believe that you will also be joined by Council Member Gary Hooser, Friends of Mahalapu's Bridget Hammerquist, and possibly Representative Candidate Fern Rosensteel, talking both what's going on locally here, where there's need for movement, need for change, and some background. But something I really liked, I'd like to get one of these timelines that you had up on the wall there, was a timeline of the history of the United States in terms of the corporations' rise in strength from really very early on in the whole event. And I wonder if you can kind of run through that timeline a little bit with the listener, just to give you some context, is that on this show we have been doing a good deal of looking at the history of Hawaii, and I see so many similarities of what has happened to the United States as well as happened to the nation of Hawaii. And I will say Hawaii might be an occupied nation, but it's within another occupied nation, almost within an occupied globe. But can you give the listener some of the knowledge of the types of things and when the shift went from, representing the citizen to where the government really represents the corporations, and then the role of the regulators?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And the sad news is that I'm going to slightly reframe what you said, because
okay.
We believe in the community rights movement that we never actually had a government that represented the citizens. So we're trying to really build that for the first time, that we had a system of law in the United States that looked like a democratic republic, but didn't quack like a democratic republic.
Can I stop you for a second? Does that even include the Articles of Incorporation? I mean, right after the American Revolution.
Confederation, you mean?
The Articles of Confederation. What did I say?
Incorporation.
I'm sorry. I meant Articles of Confederation. Those happened right after the Revolution.
Yeah, so we had very briefly a true democratic republic with the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, but even under that system of law where the state and the local governments, state and local populations, had authority and were empowered to be part of the governing system, it was a strong state, weak federal system as opposed to what we have now, which is the reverse. But even then, for that first 10 years or so, only white propertied men were persons under law, which, depending on which history book you read, is somewhere between 1 and 10% of the human population in the 13 colonies at that point. So that really wasn't a democratic republic in any honest sense of the word, but, you know, a couple of percent of people are the only people who can vote, who can sue, who can testify in court, who have any legal standing or personhood at all. That didn't really shift substantially until the mid to late 1800s. And by then, when women and black people who were freed from slavery were mobilizing for personhood and rights, that was the beginning of the 1% white property male men deciding to start using the corporation as a business structure to pack all sorts of new constitutional rights into, so that they now hide behind the corporate veil with all of their superhuman rights. So we went from kind of making a longer history lesson, a couple of sentences. So I hope it makes sense to the listeners, but we went from a first century of white property men as slaveholders to a second century of corporations having more constitutional rights than we do. And so we argue in the community rights movement that we've never actually lived in a functional majority rule society.
And I saw in that timeline that it highlighted something I hadn't given consideration to before, how slavery was actually written right into the Constitution.
Right. The word slavery doesn't appear, but three-fifths of a person appears in the Constitution.
And then
how they counted slaves.
And then if somebody who was essentially property in one state and they left to another state, that they had to be returned.
That's right, because they were simply property, yeah. And in fact, if you helped a slave escape across a state boundary, you were in violation of a property crime. You had stolen property. But I haven't really answered your the other attached part of your question, which was the timeline. And the timeline that I have, that I'll have up again tonight, corporate personhood timeline, starts in the 1700s and goes to the present and is a long analysis of the key U.S. Supreme Court decisions where corporations were granted new constitutional rights one after another, starting in 1819, which is now 196 years of corporations being granted constitutional protections. And a lot of people have heard of corporate personhood, but corporate personhood for corporations didn't start until 1886, and I'm talking about corporate constitutional rights starting in 1819. So there's about 70 years there where non-personhood corporate rights were taking place as well. So what you end up with in a nutshell is corporate First Amendment free speech rights, corporate property rights, corporate religious freedom rights, corporate rights against search and seizure, corporate privacy rights, corporate rights to a jury trial, and on and on and on. 196 years of corporations winning constitutional rights, almost entirely through the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you think about it, the judiciary is not supposed to make law. They're supposed to interpret law. That's their function. And in this case, for almost two centuries now, the U.S. Supreme Court has been making law. It's been defining new rights in the corporation, in the Constitution for corporations.
And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is Paul Cienfuegos. A question that I have with that is, with that creation, well, actually, I want to start with this. You were wearing a T-shirt last night that I thought really had a very good statement on that. Can you share the slogan that was on your T-shirt?
Yes. It says, I'm wearing it now, and I'll read it upside down. It says, slavery is the legal fiction that a person is property. Corporate personhood is the legal fiction that property is a person.
Right. Slavery is a legal fiction that a person is property, and
corporate personhood is the legal fiction that property is a person.
So tell the listener what a legal fiction is.
So corporations are considered a legal fiction in the sense that a corporation exists in the legal world, but it doesn't exist in the material world. It's a fiction. In the material world. In other words, if I asked you to take a picture of Monsanto Corporation or Syngenta Corporation, you couldn't actually do that. You could take a picture of its headquarters, its board of directors, its agricultural fields, but you couldn't take a picture of the property called Monsanto Corporation, because it's simply a mind-made structure of law. It's a business structure. And in fact, a corporation doesn't even exist in reality until a state government authorizes it into existence. That's the whole Articles of Incorporation situation.
And then when we look at Hawaii Revised Statute Number 1, I liked how you underscored what our Constitution says about the rule of law and where is the source of authority. Do you remember that offhand?
I'm totally sidetracked by things happening around me. Could you just repeat that again? I'm in a car with a lot of chaos going on.
Yes. And you will be here pretty soon, yes?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, we are, unfortunately, we got here so late that we're having to pick up a key at the Tilbury School, and then I'm being dropped off at your place.
Okay. And, so the Hawaii Revised Statute number 1, where it is looking at, I can even pull it up on my computer here, was talking about basically the premise of the source of law for Hawaii. Do you remember that? You were speaking of that, and you were referencing it last night.
I'm not understanding. The promise of the source of law?
Yeah, the very beginning of our Constitution in the state of Hawaii. Perhaps I need to pull it up, and we can come back to that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have access to my workshop files right now. They're in the car, so. Yeah.
Okay, so how about speaking to what's going on with the regulators?
Sure. And even that, I'd love to pull up a quote, which I won't be able to do till I get in the studio that I used last night. But the whole story about regulatory law and the history of regulatory law in the United States is really fascinating. And you hear all the time groups like, I'm on the mainland, so I'll use mainland examples, but groups like the Sierra Club or Food and Water Watch, you'll see these advocacy organizations putting out action alerts saying things like, the USDA has seized, or I'm sorry, Monsanto has seized control of the USDA, or another corporation has seized control of the Food Drug Administration, for example. And the problem with that analysis is it's dead wrong, that all of these regulatory agencies were never under the control of the public to begin with. I mean, the bizarre and surreal history of regulatory agencies would really blow people's minds. And I'll talk a little bit about that also this evening, that in the origin of the regulatory system of law was in the 1880s, when the Attorney General of the United States met privately with the corporate executives of the railroad industry, which were the first giant U.S. corporations, and they came up with a whole new system of law that would make it more and more difficult for we the people to have any real authority over what corporations did. Up until then, corporate charters were created by state legislatures uniquely one at a time, and their corporate charters were written by state legislatures in such a way that the legislature would define as a subordinate entity what the corporation was required to do and was not allowed to do. And if it violated its charter in a significant way, the corporation charter was revoked, the assets seized, and sometimes the directors in prison. And that took place for almost the first century in the United States. Corporations were understood to be subordinate. And with the birth of the Industrial Revolution in the mid to late 1800s, it became more and more apparent that you couldn't prohibit corporations from causing harm. That wasn't going to work for massive economic growth, which is what the 1% was looking to achieve. And so they redesigned the way that the state related to corporations, and they went from prohibiting corporate harm to regulating corporate harm. And so the birth of the regulatory agency structure happens in the 1880s with the Interstate Commerce Commission. That's the first regulatory agency, and it worked so well in tying the citizenry's hands together so that they were less and less effective, that it worked so well that other corporate industrial sectors then demanded their own regulatory agencies. So when the EPA or the USDA or the Food and Drug Administration or the Federal Communications Commission or the National Labor Relations Board or Hawaii's own environmental agencies or health agencies or ag agencies, when they make a ruling and we wonder to ourselves, why is it that they are siding generally with the corporate players and not
the
90% of the people who've testified who are saying no to the corporate proposal, it's because the entire system of law is structured in such a way as to be on the side of the corporate players, not on the side of we the people, the sovereign people. The system was designed that way. And activists have a really hard time believing this. But if you just look at the anecdotal evidence going back decades and decades, it's more like a crapshoot. It's more like gambling, the way that we deal with our regulatory agencies. You know, we get excited when just occasionally we get a regulatory agency to side with we the people and stop a harmful corporate activity. And we think, oh, finally the system is working the way it was designed. Well, actually, no, that was one of those rare exceptions, like a gambling addict where you win just often enough that you keep gambling. And so what we need to do is to democratize the whole system that governs and defines corporate behavior, because right now all of our regulatory agencies are led by industrial leaders from the industries that are being regulated. And again, that's how this is designed also, because where better to find an expert to run a regulatory agency than from the industry that's being regulated? So when you go to a regulatory public hearing and you get your 2 or 3 minutes to testify, and then you're supposed to shut up and sit down afterwards.
Mm-hmm. You
know, what most people don't realize is that you're on corporate turf playing by corporate rules.
And we have a musician around here who has a really great song, and it's called 2 Minutes, and that's by Lico Martin, and he's singing about this whole process that happens
right.
in Hawaii, and he's going, you got 2 minutes and be on your way. You know, he's pretty funny about how he brings it up. But I think that, like, what we've seen with the cell towers and the pesticides and so many different things, that it's usually literally illegal for a community to protect itself from corporate harm. Like, we are not allowed to do that. An example of which is this Pioneer lawsuit. It was the families in Waimea suing Pioneer, and they had to... These are people who are just downwind. They had to craft this lawsuit such that it's about property values. The houses have less property value because of the dust, even though so many of them had profound health reasons to go in. They were not allowed to argue the health issue. And then they finally got in a settlement. This is called a bellwether lawsuit, which means it sets a criteria in the future for other people, you know, getting this, that might be making a lawsuit on this point. But where it's a very, very mixed blessing, almost like a lose-lose situation, is for their lawyer, he's getting a percentage of the take. And he worked for a long time to be able to do this, borrowed money to be able to do it. You know, he needs to get paid. But for these people, to get them out, like the settlement amount was like $15,000 per person for damage to the property value of their houses. Well, I mean, that is so reduced from what the reality of it is. But if they sign that, then they have to sign a waiver saying they will never go after them for their own health crises. And most of the people who stood up to actually sue really got involved because of profound health challenges. So no one wins in this. If these people capitulate and sign for a pittance of damages, they hardly get any money. If they refuse to sign, then the attorney who's worked for probably 10 years on it gets nothing. If they do sign and they get this little bit of money and the attorney gets the money, well, their real challenge has been extinguished. So to me, that is an example that's local of what you're speaking to.
Yes, and that's just increasingly the norm. And, you know, you started this example by saying nobody wins. And I would say, well, there is actually one player that wins, and it's the system. Or if there's a major business corporation involved, they win. They win big. But certainly the community loses and nature loses. Absolutely right. And I don't know if you follow this, but increasingly large corporations are making customers sign these massive contracts that they don't even understand what they're signing. And one of the things that they're signing away their rights to a class action lawsuit, that the companies are increasingly requiring that in a conflict with the company, there will be no class action lawsuit, and instead you'll be required to go into mediation with the company and the company will choose the mediator.
Right.
And that's all you get.
So it's a very stacked deck. And by the way, I did pull up the Constitution of the State of Hawaii, and people can see it at, like, irbhawaii.org. And so I'm looking right at the Constitution. This is Article 1, Bill of Rights, Political Power. So Section 1 of Article 1 says, all political power of this state is inherent in the people, and the responsibility for the exercise thereof rests with the people. All government is founded on this authority. So it's that was like a central premise of these lawsuits and these, or more than the lawsuits, the ordinances that you're speaking of, or the Bill of Rights that come from communities, that they go, look, here, right at the beginning of what we have, and this is the one for Hawaii, but is there's usually
right.
a piece in their own constitution that says, no, this rests with the people, not the political fiction of that person, too, the all caps, Felicia Cowden or whatever, where that's our corporate selves.
Right.
It rests with the people.
Pretty much every single state in the United States has language that's similar to that at the beginning of their state constitution. I don't know if you're hearing that.
I missed
all sorts of noise on my phone.
I missed. Yeah, go ahead.
Your state constitution is actually somewhat weaker than many in that section, but it also has public trust doctrine stuff later on in it that's quite powerful. But unfortunately, if we the people don't understand that we are the sovereign, which means that government is required to serve us and has duties to us, it's accountable to us, and that we delegate certain responsibilities to government, and if we don't delegate specific responsibilities, that means that we hold that authority ourselves as the citizenry. But if we don't understand who we are in relationship to our business and our government institutions, then we're basically screwed. And most of us don't understand that. And so our single issue activism is mostly ineffective, be it environmental activism, labor activism, social justice activism, because by and large what conventional activist groups are doing is the kind of activism where you're pleading with the power holders, with the decision makers, be that your county council, your state legislature, your governor, the president, or a regulatory agency director who's not even elected but appointed by a governor or a president. And so our work is about exercising our self-governing authority rather than imagining that all decision-making authority is outside of us and we just have to find the right person and beg them to do the right thing. It's a disaster the way that our activism currently works, unfortunately. And when I say this to folks who've been working very hard within conventional advocacy organizations, it's a hard thing for them to hear because they're all really good people and they're all working really hard, but they're working within a system of law that's designed to fail our needs as we the people, as, you know, as nature needing protection.
I saw a post on social media where it likened the people to a lion in a circus, and that the lion really has the power over the trainer. Did you bring that up? I think was that part of yours?
I'm sorry, I got sidetracked again by a conversation. Try again.
I saw a little video where it was likening the people who are overwhelmed by their government, where they are disempowered by the government. But they likened, the metaphor was that those people are like a lion, a tamed lion in a circus, you know, that really that lion could just take over their trainer if they knew their own power, and that the thing that's needed is for people to know their own power.
Yes. It's absolutely true, and I think, you know, when you see campaigns like Bernie Sanders' campaign, it's one of these, you know, lights in the darkness where you realize that somebody who's running for president can actually outraise in money someone who is as corporate as any candidate has ever been, you know, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton. And she's having a really hard time keeping up with him because he's gathering all of these tiny little donations from 3 or 4 million people now. And so, you know, it's tragic that we need tens of millions of dollars to elect a president. And most of that is because corporations have constitutional rights. We have to pay for corporate advertising on corporate media. But just the fact that we can now witness that you actually don't need corporate money to run for president if you're saying things that resonate with people is actually, you know, an incredible breath of fresh air and a reminder of how powerful grassroots Americans can be if we're organized. And really, there's a famous saying in community organizing, which is that the only thing that can out-organize organized money is organized people.
Yes, and speaking of that organization, I want to thank you again for being at Kilauea School Cafeteria tonight at 6 p.m. Tomorrow night at Kalaheo Neighborhood Center, that's Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Koloa Neighborhood Center, Thursday night at 6 p.m. And then Chiefs Kamakahele Middle School Cafeteria the following Monday night, May 16th at 6 p.m. That's in Lihue, or really Puhi. So you're coming over, thanks to Friends of Mahalapu, doing these workshops around the island. And in each group, it's actually a panel discussion. So you represent a bird's eye view of community organizations from around the United States having effective action. But when people go to these workshops, they're going to be also hearing from local political leaders and activists and community organizers on having effect. Now, the higher focus is agriculture, is the bigger focus of what is being demanded here. But just as you're saying that it really, you don't need to separate it out of there, what your dialogue is on is really creating a locally based Bill of Rights. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, that is absolutely correct. That each of our ordinances, and I'm glad you're mentioning this because I haven't said a really crucial thing about what each of these ordinances does. Actually, I think I maybe said it at the very beginning, but I've been in such chaos in this car environment that I'm in for this interview that I haven't held my interview skills together as well as I usually do. I just keep losing my train of thought, so my apologies.
So we're talking about community-based Bill of Rights. And where
Bill
are,
of Rights, yeah,
yeah. Where are you right now? Are you almost to Princeville?
No, we are still at the Kilauea School, and I have no idea exactly what is going on.
Mm.
I could.
Okay, so let's get back to locally-based Bill of Rights.
Do you maybe want to take a break for a moment from me so I can find out what's happening here?
Okay, and then you can call back. We'll put you on hold. Marshall,
okay.
Can you put him on hold, and then we'll bring you back up in a little bit.
Okay.
So, Marshall, I hope that you can make it tonight to this event. It is really very, very meaningful and good.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see coming out of it?
Well, I actually see a lot coming out of it. What I see is putting things in perspective, because he has the legal documents there and of how and why we are disempowered in the way that we're disempowered. And I would say here in Hawaii, we are a little bit further down the road than many places, thanks to our Kanaka Maoli protesters or protectors who've been coming up. We've had 5 Supreme Court decisions that have actually spanked the Hawaii state government for cheating, for jumping ahead and missing key steps that they know. There's really no excuse. When you have an intervener status lawsuit or an intercessor, I think a lot of these different words, like I'm not in this this industry, but our attorney general certainly is, the state is, they're the ones who set the laws. And they are knowingly taking little skips. So if they see that they're maybe not going to win at a certain step, they skip that step. And then it becomes a case of just saying, oh, yeah, that's how it is. But it's not how it is. And even at the local level, we have our boards and commissions, and bless their hearts, the people who work on the boards and commissions, but those aren't elected. They are not elected, and there it is not up to anybody, really, who gets picked for that. There's a public hearing. I have actually spoken objection to a few this year, and, you know, you're almost ridiculed for coming out and providing testimony, and not everybody picked even really has the skill set. Plus, for some of these groups, like the Planning Commission, it's a tremendous amount of responsibility, and these are unpaid jobs. So I'll be honest, I kind of love the Planning Department. I think that they work well and they do a good job. But, and we are just racing forward quickly on these agendas of items that there's hardly the knowledge on, hardly any kind of institutional memory. So ideas are brought up, picked, done, and
So again, tonight, how do you see it affecting going forward in the context of everything you've just said?
Well, I think it will affect a lot of things, because when people realize how the Constitution of the United States has been a little bit hijacked, so has the state, and that there's what do we call it? It's like designed into the system, you know? It's designed into the system from the very onset to benefit those who profit from exploitation of the land, not to benefit for the people. And how you grab those key points and start to wrest them. And what's really good in his story with this is that he's had 200 lawsuits and that he's been a part of, like they had 200 community activism efforts that have been able to get an ordinance or a law or some sort of change to benefit the people. And I don't want to, you know, maybe give away some of these stories that he might be bringing out, but they're powerful stories. And then those corporations have sued the people, and the people have stood up, and as soon as they stand up, the companies run. They don't want the lawsuit to go to fruition, but actually 85% of them, the companies simply left and went somewhere else, because they know if it actually goes all the way through to the decisions, when it is based on the citizen rights, instead of right there where he's saying, you know, you can't be arguing it on their terms. If you're arguing it on the citizens' terms, and this organization helps people to see a pathway of arguing it on citizen terms, that, you know, the corporations will go to another community where they don't have that resistance.
Mm-hmm. So at the Kapa'a event, then, did you see people coming together, connecting in a way that they would form groups to take this new information and empowerment and, initiate new...
Well, like what he was just saying is that you actually don't want to form small groups. You want to come together. We were happy that there were a few conservatives at the meeting there last night. It was more... Well, I mean, Hawaii is more non-conservative, but, you know, what we will do is work to create... a ballot initiative that helps to create the rights of the local and community self-government. It's a short window of time to be able to create that and get it on to the ballot for this upcoming season. But like what happened when we had some ballot initiatives in the past, even just like last year when the people who were concerned about the pesticides and they wanted to regulate the pesticides, because the companies are saying, hey, It's not drifting. So then the thing was, okay, fair enough. You can get a permit. The permit will pay for the test to show that, in fact, these pesticides aren't drifting. And if you've got it, okay, you get the next permit. Well, you know, there was a lot of gaming that went on. There was a few flaws. I'll be honest about that. There was a few flaws in that initiative that did not fit comfortably with the charter, but it got kicked out twice. You know, it never really made it onto the ballot. But what's happened now, the Charter Review Commission, and people were hand-selected that are going to be constraining the citizen rights. hand-selected to be in there, and one of the key ones is now he's competent, and that's almost problematic. He's competent, and he's the head of the Charter Review Commission. And so people hardly go to those meetings, like don't go to those meetings. I've tried to get people to go to those meetings. But, you know, what one of the things that will be on the ballot is to make it much harder for people to get something on the ballot again, right? And then there's was a lot of dialogue on who gets to decide if what the citizens come up with is okay to actually go on the ballot. And, again, it, you know, they keep wanting to put it to a staff member that is within the station. You're looking at the phone. Should I see if he's on? We can pull
no,
him
no,
off.
I'm just watching for a second call. Do you want to see if he's there?
Okay, we'll see. Hi, are you there?
Yeah, I've been listening for quite a while now.
Okay, all right. So you can jump back into the conversation.
Yeah, I think I just wanted to correct one thing that I heard, which is that the 200 communities were not legally challenged. The corporations did. Corporations never challenged. Corporate lawyers never challenged 95%.
Oh, 95. I think I said 85.
95% of the 200 communities were never legally challenged. They were never sued by the corporations or the state. And I don't want to make this sound too utopian as a vision, because I think early on in this movement, one of the reasons that corporate lawyers are choosing not to challenge these early ordinances is that in most cases they can simply go to another community and cause harm there and assume that there'll be less public opposition there. But the other reason I think you stated pretty accurately, which is that for corporate lawyers to be challenging these laws, I think it's the second reason why so few laws have been challenged so far, but I think this is going to change in the upcoming years, is that the laws are written in such a way to force the corporate attorneys to have to make the argument that the constitutional rights of corporations trump the constitutional rights of we the people of that community, that township, that county, that our constitutional protected rights, our Bill of Rights protections are basically irrelevant in our own communities, that corporations can come in and do anything they want. And the crazy reality is that it's true. But if I say that to a group of concerned citizens, people are going to be shocked, but they're not going to have the same response as if a corporate attorney in your county courthouse says exactly the same statement, that your rights are irrelevant, they don't matter, we can do anything we want in your town. That's really not what corporate lawyers want to have to argue in a court of law.
Well, when we have these preemption issues, I mean, I want to use that word preemption because that has been the buzzword that's always used with us when people don't want a cell tower right next to their house. You're not allowed to even speak to the fact that it might have something to do with health because of the Federal Communications Act of 1996, which is pretty much before cell phones were really truly out there, you know, and before all these technologies were out there. So they knew ahead of time. They said, okay, FCC sets the bar and nobody else can question it. And state law preempts county law. We have these political subdivisions coming down. There's like a cascade or an org chart. You know, the people down at the bottom have very little capacity to make these choices. They're like, the county gets to mow the lawn and sweep the park, flush the toilet, fix the roads. You know, they're not allowed to have much policy.
But here's where I would kind of you to take what you've just said further, because what you said is spot on. But the problem is when people say, oh, the 1996 Telecommunications Act forbids us to do X, Y, and Z to protect our cell towers, what doesn't happen next and what needs to start happening next urgently is for the public to say, why? Why does the Telecommunications Act make it impossible for us to protect ourselves from cell phone tower emissions? And if they started digging, and almost no one ever does, what they would discover is that the act that embedded in this act that's larger than the Manhattan New York City phone book, I mean, it's thicker than that. It's the thickest act ever passed by Congress. and almost nobody read it. And embedded in the act, it says that corporations shall be considered, I'm blanking on the phrase, shall be considered persons as if they were black persons under civil rights era legislation. That the 1964 Civil Rights Act, protecting black people from discrimination, is the law that corporate rights are embedded in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. So they're actually arguing that to say you can't put a cell phone tower next to a family's bedroom window in a neighborhood would discriminate against a corporate cell phone tower, a cell phone tower corporation, as if the corporation was a racially discriminated against family.
That's amazing.
Now, when people understand that, which they're never going to understand unless we start asking why, when the state says you can't do that, that's state preemption, why? Why? And you keep asking why, and you keep insisting on understanding, and, you know, it's amazing when people stop conceding that they have no authority over these ridiculous rules, and they start insisting on understanding why they have no authority, then the story starts to unpeel. And then it starts getting really interesting. So, for example,
we're at the top of the hour. You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox. Paul Cienfuegos is on the line with us. Continue.
So when I read the first 8 or 10 pages of the lawsuit by Syngenta and DuPont, I forget all of the companies that are suing
Dow
Kauai
and
County
and BASF.
Against the law that you passed, all you have to do is get into the first 6 or 8 pages of what I think is 70 or 80 page lawsuit, and you hit the bonanza really early on, and it's always there because a corporation can't claim that you can't do what you're doing unless they argue based on what law. And what are the laws that they're arguing? The corporate lawyers are saying that the Kauai County law against pesticide spraying violates a whole variety of corporate constitutional rights, which they have to name. It violates state preemption. They had to name that. It even says that the county is a mere subdivision of the state, and therefore doesn't have inherent authority of its own. And what that means in translation is that they're arguing something called Dillon's Rule, D-I-L-L-O-N apostrophe S. John Forrest Dillon was a late 1800s Iowa State Supreme Court judge who decided and started utilizing in his decision that the proper relationship between the state and local governments is that of parent to child, and that the child, the local government, only has the authority granted to it by the parent, the state government, and no other authority is allowed. And so these corporate players are arguing in their lawsuit that the county doesn't have authority because it's a mere subdivision of the state. It doesn't exist with its own integrity under its own standing authority. And again, if the public understands the why, then they start saying, this is ridiculous, this is an outrage, we're not going to stand for this anymore, we're the sovereign people, we're going to stand up for our rights.
So, just for clarity, this judge, John Forrest Dillon, I can't remember which state you said, it sounded like a Midwestern state.
Iowa.
Iowa. This is what's called settled law. So just because this one individual made this interpretation, it becomes the law of the land.
That's right. And then lawsuit after lawsuit is based on it, and then it becomes federal law.
So none of these
legal precedent.
None of these people, from the regulators to the judges, are elected. They're all appointed people, correct?
State judges are usually elected, and federal judges are usually appointed. So corporate players almost always try to go to federal judges, not state judges, because they're more insulated from the people. They don't have to speak. They don't have to represent the people's interests. But it's a little bit deceptive because if you've ever voted for state judge on your state ballot, what usually happens is there's only one judge running for each position, and you don't get to find out what their beliefs are about the issues that matter. So it almost doesn't matter that they're elected because you have no clue who you're electing anyway.
Here in Hawaii, we do not have elected judges, but that was another ballot initiative. I'd have to look to see how it went. We did not have elected judges, but when we had a good 5 court decisions this year that really sided with the people, then they came up, hey, let's elect our judges. You know, I knew when we had this thing on this 30-meter telescope, when they sided with the, I don't want to say the Hawaiians, but with First Peoples from here, Hawaiian people, some people who are of Hawaiian bloodline who are practitioners, they stood up and they said no. And what happened, what we saw in that, was the very, very hard game that goes on when you do stand against authority. We had something here called Aloha Aina. Kapu Aloha. Kapu Aloha, that means always to be nonviolent, always to be operating in love when the Department of Land and Natural Resources police force is coming up and taking them away. On Maui, they got a little rough. On Hawaii Island, it was relatively good, but it took, you know, everything from massive prayer to hundreds of people. I don't know if you followed it, but there's 9 months of camping out at 9,000 feet. It's cold up there to be able to resist this. So they did an emergency set of rules to say, okay, it's a crime to have a backpack or a big bottle of water or a sleeping bag or any kind of evidence of intention of staying warm and supplied for a decent period of time up on the mountain. And they made those rules. Is kind of absurd. You know, an emergency is a tidal wave or a lava flow, and the courts sided with the people, and they said no. And these people were standing there exercising their First Amendment rights to stop violations that the state was doing and breaking the breaking form for what they were supposed to do. So it worked for them. But then this season, and they just only defeated it last Tuesday. I mean, this is just a constant battle. They had a state legislature saying, all right, it's a crime if you don't follow written lines. Like, they could put a sign up that says, this area of state property is closed at 5 o'clock, you have to leave. You know, it's closed at 5 o'clock. So if people don't leave that area at 5 o'clock, then they are violating a crime, and there's a reason to legitimately arrest them. So it's this trap, this constraining piece that moves against the rights of the people. But Hawaii is very, I would say, courageous. We have unity among these neighbor islands since the internet has really been bringing social media, and people are standing together and they are standing up for justice. And it's so far, people haven't gotten badly hurt, but it's high impact.
It is. It's very high impact. And, you know, Frederick Douglass says, you know, the abolitionist and freed slave, he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. And, you know, if all we do is sign online petitions begging the power holders, we're going to lose. But that's not a demand. And I think more and more people don't understand that real community organizing is required, which is very different than online networking through social media. But media is a terrific medium for getting people mobilized and connected and alerted once the relationship has been established, once the trust is there. But how do you reach across the political boundaries of left and right wing and old and young and white and other colors? You have to actually do outreach. You have to do organizing. You have to go door to door or stand on street corners and reach out to people who are different than you, who may have very different viewpoints than you on a whole variety of topics. But in terms of protecting your local air and water and food, you're probably 80% united. And you maybe don't even realize it yet. Until you actually reach out, you're not going to actually build those alliances that can hold.
I'm giving a high five to our community, and I can tell even from looking at it that I've got people from the different islands listening in. And Kauai Community Radio is actually a unifying force, and I hope that, like, next week we have our fun drive, that people really remember that. You know, Kauai is a force to be reckoned with, and we have been very strong at being resistive of actions that aren't good for us. And I will tell you, it does cross the racial lines. It does cross the gender lines and the age. And last summer, we had something called a Unity March, and I went over to Oahu for it, and there was probably 10,000 people going down the main drag in Waikiki.
Wow.
On Kalakaua Avenue. And though in the news, when they're talking about it in the news, they give it, you know, 30 seconds after they talk about a fundraiser for a baseball team. You know, demonstrators walked down the street. You know, there were hundreds of people there. Well, there were thousands of people. We saw better coverage of it in England and New Zealand and, you know, other places in Polynesia.
Yeah.
But on the internet, it's happening, and the leaders they know, and some of our groups, you know, people from all over the islands come together, and they surrounded the First Hawaiian Bank building, and they closed that building to be able to serve papers to the law company that is representing the telescope. And by the way, one of the lead attorneys from that was then appointed as the attorney general. You know, it's just amazing. It's shameless, the
yeah.
conflict of interest that happens there, and then the denigration of the people
yeah.
who stand up. But
well, and
we're good here.
I'm incredibly excited about how social media has helped to even the disparity of power. With the corporate media, it's incredibly exciting. And, again, the Bernie Sanders campaign is a really good example of how well it's working. But I have to say that until we actually reclaim our authority over those corporations, too, ABC, Fox, NPR, PBS, CBS,
Facebook,
et cetera, right? Amazon, these are all giant corporations that now are our media. And, you know, we give them all sorts of authority by saying they're our mainstream media and our community radio stations are somehow alternative media. But really, the real media is democratic media. And I lead a workshop that I'd love to come back and lead sometime in your community called How to Take Back Our Local Mass Media Corporations. So that, in other words, the Fox affiliate, the NPR or PBS affiliate, the CBS affiliate, the local corporate daily newspaper, if you have that on your island.
We do.
In other words, you know, our work is about resubordinating the legal fiction called the corporation, getting it back under our control, under our defining authority, and saying this media, this news coverage was unacceptable. You know, the way that you're dealing with letters to the editor or our guest op-eds is unacceptable. Your analysis is unacceptable. Here are the new requirements that you're going to be fulfilling as our daily newspaper, as our local TV news, whatever. And we're going to treat you just the way our descendants treated subordinate corporations 150 years ago, unless you understand that it's a privilege and not a right to be running the newspaper for our community or the TV news station for our community. And unless you fulfill certain requirements and obligations and duties and responsibilities to us, to we the people, we're going to make sure that you can't operate in our community. It's the same exact message. Corporations need to be resubordinated, and they were for the first century, and we need to think very carefully as we the people about what the bottom line requirements would be for our media corporations. We need to think about that for our manufacturing corporations and our energy corporations and our logging corporations and our agricultural corporations, and decide what are the bottom line requirements, be they labor rights, ecological sustainability, etc. And only corporations that meet those bottom line requirements are allowed to operate in our communities and our states. And that's the movement that existed in the late 1700s and early 1800s. And now we're, back then only 1% of us could vote or mobilize publicly as persons, and now most of us have personhood. So we don't really have a good excuse other than not understanding our history and not understanding who we are, what our proper relationship is with our corporations and our governments, both of which are constitutionally subordinate, if we dare to treat them that way.
And thank you, Paul Cienfuegos. You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. Paul and a number of other panelists are here tonight, Kilauea School Cafeteria, 6 p.m. I know Gary Hooser, I believe, and Fern Rosensteel and Bridget Hammerquist will be on that panel. Tomorrow night, 6 p.m., Kalaheo Neighborhood Center on the south side, Kaloa Neighborhood Center on Thursday, 6 p.m., and then Chiefs Kamakahele Middle School Cafeteria Monday, May 16th. While we're talking about media, I need to take a moment and give a thank you out to those that are supporting us. So I'll be back with you in about 2 minutes. Okay, Paul?
Great.
Okay, and Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Copper Man.
KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Anahola, K284AL, Haleiwa.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com. Or 639-3456.
Shh. It's KKCR's Silent Fund Drive. From now until the start of our spring membership drive on May 12th, we encourage you to participate in our Silent Drive. All Silent Drive contributors will be entered into our early bird drawing for a chance to win a two-night stay at the beautiful Hanalei Bay Resort in Princeville. Our goal is $60,000. Help us get there by making a donation today. Call 808-826-7774 or visit kkcr.org. KKCR, Ke Kani o Kauai Nei, the sound of Kauai.
Aloha, listeners of KKCR. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global news hour, urging you to support Kauai Community Radio. As a beacon of free speech, KKCR has been broadcasting from their jungle shack and building community in the island since 1997. KKCR brings you Hawaiian culture and music, independent voices and choices like Democracy Now!, otherwise shut out from the corporate media. During this program, please show your love for KKCR by making an investment in the station that loves you and become a sustaining member. Your monthly support at any level will pay dividends all year long and ensure the continued success of Kauai Community Radio. From our family at Democracy Now! To your ohana in the center of the Pacific, mahalo for your support. It really does make a difference.
The following is an important message paid for with official funds by the Office of Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard.
Aloha. We are so fortunate to live in Hawaii, but we have some seasonal disasters that are unique to our islands, and it's important that we are prepared. Hurricane season begins June 1st, so make sure that your ohana has a plan, an emergency kit, and enough food, water, and medicine to last at least 1 week. I've posted a helpful checklist and tips to stay safe at gabbard.house.gov. Mahalo.
And mahalo for listening and supporting Kauai Community Radio. Paul, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
So, hey, have you noticed our representative Tulsi Gabbard? She's got, she's got some courage.
Yes, I have. I have been paying real attention to what she has to say, and I'm impressed.
Yeah, she has really been a rising star from here, and we've been happy with the support that she has given Bernie Sanders. And, we're working within our state. She is our only superdelegate who is, at this point, giving voice that she is going to support him. I mean, she's adamantly going to support him. She, in fact, stepped down as the vice president from the Democratic National Committee because of it. But the rest of our delegates are, you know, saying that they're going to be voting for, our super delegates are going to be voting for Hillary Clinton. I am a community delegate from Kilauea, so I will be going over to our state convention. There's a whole number of us are going over there, trying to sit there and do our very best to get our super delegates to represent what the state came up with. I know in my district it was 83% for Bernie Sanders, and all precincts but three had a very significant majority for Bernie Sanders. So we're looking at, you know, how we can, you know, get our people to represent the will of, you know, the population. And
yeah, you know, Oregon's Senator Merkley was the, which is where I live, was he was the first senator, and in fact, he might still be the only senator, I'm not sure, to have come out officially as a superdelegate for Bernie Sanders. And it's, yeah, it's just been a, it's been an absolutely fascinating roller coaster ride to watch the presidential election unfold.
And when we see, like, Washington State, every single county went for him, and yet zero of the superdelegates are... And there's a number of states like that. And so I think that, you know, it's a giant wake-up call to everybody when
yes,
we
is.
See how broken is our election system. It's basically just a private party.
So on both sides, yeah. And, you know, I am no fan of Donald Trump, but I also understand that he is drawing from the right enormous support as an anti-establishment candidate as well. And intriguingly, he's opposed to the global trade treaties. He's been adamantly opposed to them for decades. So we might actually, if we end up with a President Trump, which is not what I'm hoping, we might end up getting a much, being much more successful in getting the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, canceled, which we're certainly not going to get from Hillary Clinton. There's a number of other positions that are very anti-corporate establishment that Trump takes that are much stronger than Hillary Clinton's position, such as that he's not into invading and occupying one country after another. And Hillary seems to be just the opposite again. So you've got grassroots mobilization going on across the political spectrum, saying enough is enough. And I think that's really exciting.
Well, I think that that's really exciting as well. You know, that we have you know, such a vibrant conversation, and real issues are coming out. Although I will say that I get most of my knowledge from alternative press, and I look at the mainstream media, but it is the minority of the input. So I find that there's a very big unfolding of awareness. And
yes.
And when you see, I'm really pleased to see in California how there are big crowds coming up, you know, and coming out for Bernie Sanders, even when the mainstream press is pretty much writing him off. You know, they're just saying this is a Clinton-Trump
thing. Wrote him off from the very beginning before he was even running. When he was announcing, he was being written off. I understand he won another state today. He won Virginia. Is that correct?
That's correct. He won West Virginia.
West Virginia.
And then Marshall
and
could
he's
probably...
He's likely to win Oregon, my state, on May 17. And he seems to have a good shot at winning California on June 7 and some other states as well. So
California will be really the most critical of them. Marshall is on the phone. So Marshall, you had is there somebody holding that wants to come on the line? We're going to try this if we can. Paul was meant to be in the studio. It seems like you're not going to be coming in. We can take you for about another 5 minutes, and I know you have to go in and get ready. But we're going to try and do two calls at once. Aloha, caller. You're on the line.
Yes. Aloha. This is Andy Saharnis. I was in Kapaa last night.
Uh-huh.
And I also attended a workshop Paul gave 2 years ago in Southern Oregon. And it's clear to me that Paul has the most outstanding way to go about to find the weaknesses in the system and exploit them. It's basically we have to go back to what our founding fathers did to upset the tyranny of the Crown of England and stand up to them and tell them no. But we. But my question to Paul is, if when he goes and does a work, when a community that has a serious threat from a corporation's proposed project in their backyards, and the community asks him to come back and do a workshop, and then how often does this lead to a successful confrontation to the particular corporation?
Well, so it's a bit of a complicated answer. It's a really important question. So I am on the road about half of every month in a variety of states around the United States. It sometimes takes me 2, 3, 4 visits to a community before the group seems kind of culturally and organizationally ready to launch an ordinance campaign. There's all sorts of variables as to whether the state allows local ballot initiatives or not. Only about half the states do. So if you're running a ballot initiative campaign, it's a very different campaign that you're launching than if you're trying to convince your county or city or town local elected officials.
We can do it here.
Just from the energy in Kapaha last night, it seemed like there were already maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 folks who would be excited about joining an exploratory working group, a Kauai-wide working group, to start thinking about what a ballot initiative ordinance language would look like and to start doing public education. And I think one of the things that people forget is how unusual the community rights work is, that it's really paradigm-shifting work, and it requires a serious intellectual an organizational commitment to do this work, and it requires some years potentially as well, because you're challenging these very settled structures of law within a legal system that really doesn't want those structures to be challenged. So the barricades go up on a regular basis to try to stop you. So I would say if this county was serious about running a community rights ballot initiative on the dairy factory farm or pesticides or some other topic, you know, I think ideally you're looking for a minimum of a dozen folks who would be willing to make a 5 or 10 hour commitment for a couple of years. And that's not the kind of activism that most of us are used to committing to. We're kind of short attention span, multi-issue activists, most of us, who are politically engaged and concerned. So I would say, you know, if you could get a dozen folks like that and dozens of folks who want to help around the edges, you know, within the next 3 to 6 months of effort, then you're going to be able to build a really strong campaign. But it's going to require some of you doing the historical and strategic research necessary so that you become experts in the rise of corporate constitutional rights history. And I mean layperson experts. I don't mean you've got to go to law school. It just means that you're doing some significant study and reflection and, you know, giving yourself lots of practice to teach in small groups and then larger groups around the county. And building, because what we're doing is we're challenging unjust structures of law that haven't been challenged in more than a century. And so this is not like single-issue organizing. We refer to it more as paradigm shift organizing.
Thank you. And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Soapbox, Paul Cienfuegos is on the line. We have another caller, too. And Marshall, hey, guys, Marshall has some good news that's in this direction. What would you like to share, Marshall?
Oh, there's a little bit of at least temporary victory for the honeybees and a little bit of a setback for Dow AgroSciences. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has agreed with a group of commercial beekeepers that the federal regulators should not have approved the use of sulfoxaflor, which is a new nicotoid, one of the pesticides that is suspected of wreaking so much havoc with the bees. So they should not have approved it. And at this point, farmers have to immediately stop using it.
So that is a really big step.
Yeah. Now, that's not the final word on it, that he's put that into place right now, but no doubt that'll be challenged.
That is a very big deal. Very exciting.
Yes. Do I have both callers still on the air? Okay, Paul, I know you're going to need to go in and start getting ready for your 6 o'clock presentation, and there's a lot of materials that you have there. I recommend people come even just a few minutes early to be looking at the timeline. If I could make a recommendation, put the timeline away from the food so people aren't, like, competing between reading and eating. But I want to give another deep, heartfelt mahalo to the friends of Mahaulipu, because these people in that community down there have really come together, not only organizationally, but they've borrowed money, they've donated money, they have really put their money where their mouth is, and that's why they're having so much success. They are fortunate enough that they can somehow find a pocket, you know, or a bank or whatever that's able to give them the money. But when they bring people like yourself, Paul, over here, and the actions that they're taking, it helps everybody. It sets a precedent. It sets a teaching. And when Scott Enright came over to listen to them, I tried to find it to just play the recording of it. I couldn't quite pull it up. But he basically said, if every community was organized as Kaloa Poipu, then it would be a very different Hawaii. And you could tell that he was really struck with it. Still yet, they are not rolling over the Department of Ag and the Department of Health. And what I find with the Friends of Mahaulipu is that they are not, it's not like they go, oh, we don't like milk, or we don't like dairy, or we don't like these things. It's just that the facts for this kind of concentration on that kind of soil right next to the ocean, it is a mistake. And it could contaminate the water supply. And we already have contamination in the river over there. And they are beating their hearts out trying to do the right thing that would affect Kauai for a very long time. And I hate to bring it down to money also, but Kaloa and the Poipu area, that is 30% of the revenue. That's the high tax-paying area of the whole island. It's a small community to be putting out that much dollars for running our county. They are one of the high contributors from the county to the state. So you'd think even for the selfish among us that don't care about the environment or the happiness of the people, that they would still care about the dollars, you know. So it's these guys are relentless. They have that tenacity of which you're speaking. Our Hawaiian national people who have really gone the distance in learning a language that was said to be dead, reading the archives, reading the newspapers, unburying the truth in another language. There's so much commitment, and I just really, really honor the island that I live on and honor the islands that we are a part of, because beautiful, beautiful people, and spirit enough, got the whole triangle of Polynesia to pray, and guess what? It snowed in July to protect the protectors, and that's no joke.
Yes, I've also been incredibly impressed with the local friends group here that's hosting me, and hopefully I'll be back in a few months to lead a weekend intensive if enough people show interest in that. And I just wanted to kind of make a closing comment that I think the real excitement begins when local communities begin to withdraw their consent from illegitimate structures of power that aren't serving them, and that when people start to remember that we the people are the sovereign and that all government is required to serve us and has duties to serve and protect our needs and the environment, and when government isn't doing that and we begin to withdraw our consent, which is how the American Revolution began, that 90 small communities wrote declarations of independence, declaring their independence from the British Crown, and then ultimately started writing laws declaring under law their independence from the Crown. But I think what we're attempting is really similar, that when government does not serve us, that we need to withdraw our consent, and as most state constitutions even say, that we the people have the right to redesign or even abolish in some state constitutions our government in order to create a government that serves us. It's a requirement of a democratic republic. And I think withdrawing our consent is both scary but also frees up a lot of exciting new energy.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight. I'll probably be there about 6:15, maybe 6:20, because I got to leave the station here. But mahalo for supporting us in so many ways, and mahalo, friends of Mahalipu, for bringing you here and for the many other things that they have done. And if Bridget's listening, give her our love, as well as Eileen and Jan and Ellen, and, you know, there's a whole team of people. Bob.
It's an honor to be part of the local, to be here sponsored by the local group and to be on your radio show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I will see you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So you mentioned the possibility of a ballot initiative.
Yes. And, you know, I think, like, if I'm listening to him, he's saying, hey, you know, don't do it that quickly. You know, you could do a ballot initiative for this upcoming election, a reason for people to try and do it, you know, sooner rather than later is that they are, you know, trying to take that capacity away from the people. They're trying to make, you know, up the bar, make it harder. That's already an initiative that's going on by the Charter Review Commission. And you know, I mean, I think that they are relying on the fact that the people are unaware of what it is that they're voting no to. They're going to be saying, okay, let's make everything 10% when it's been 5% for ballot initiative. And they should make everything 5%. It takes so much effort to go out there and do it. And so, you know, we'll see if they get what they think, that people will vote against their own interests, you know. That's
So specifically, you're thinking of a ballot initiative that is what?
Well, what had come up is a ballot initiative that is basically strengthening. There are two different things you could do, but one is trying to do a community bill of rights. That affects the charter amendment, and that would be how to restructure the charter a bit to not place exploitative entities ahead of the health of the people in the land. So that's a structural change. I think another ballot initiative, which would probably be more of an ordinance, would be the agriculture things. An ordinance right now, to get an ordinance on the ballot, you have to have 20% of the registered voters. So that's like getting 30,000 signatures. You probably really need to get 60 because they discount so many of them. And then you can make a ballot initiative, and then the council could just, you know, change it and take it back if they want to. So that is, you know, one of the things that's there.
So Community Bill of Rights, adding that to the charter, that's that's intriguing.
Basically, that's it. You know, I mean, this is just a conversation. It has to get looked at a little bit more.
Right.
I want to say that, just give a few little shout-outs that happened this week. The county transportation plan for the general plan update. I like our planning department. I mean, people might disagree with things, but I feel like they've got a good heart. And they're sort of the opposite of what we're talking about. I mean, they're trying to balance all the different things, like including economic development. They were talking about transportation last time. And Lee Steinmetz, who we've had on before, you know, he was speaking. Mike DeHillig, the department head, you know, he's there. And, you know, I think with a really good frame of heart, they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we deal with the traffic problem? And then next month, June 13th, I believe, It's going to be housing and social justice, and the core piece of what they're looking at is housing, you know, loss of housing here.
And so did you hear any new ideas on transportation?
I mean, it was a really good conversation about, like, how do we prioritize what is the most important. I think it was pretty key that they were saying congestion and then safety. We have a caller at 826-7771. Let's just go ahead and take that, and we can come back to the other conversation. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
I just wanted to throw my two cents in here. I really admire you guys' energy and enthusiasm, and especially your positiveness. At the same time, I want to remind everyone of the Ohana Kauai initiative some years ago. Long story short, it was an initiative. Actually, it was a charter amendment, because you can't do an initiative for fiscal issues in the state of Hawaii, as I understand it. Anyway, what happened was, I collected a lot of signatures. Of course, the county disqualified as many as possible, and there were full-page ads that the sky was going to fall. Shopko and the teachers and the government workers, they were all against it, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it passed 13,000 to 8,000 to limit our property taxes. Then what happened was the county attorney sued the county council to prevent the implementation of the will of the voters. Then it went all the way to the Hawaii Supreme Court, where ultimately, again, long story short, it was ruled that the word county was not the people, in spite of, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I believe the charter says Kauai County is the body politic. Now, they ruled that it was not the body politic, it was the legislators. So it kicked it all the way back to the council. And for a few years, they did implement under Baptiste some temporary stopgap measures to sort of assuage the anger of the 13,000 people that voted for it. But the bottom line on all of this stuff...
It was under Bernard Cavallo. Brian had already passed by then, but yes. Go ahead. Continue.
Well, I'm mistaken on that. I thought Baptiste was still in office.
He passed in 2006.
So, you know, you can go through all of these steps, and ultimately you go to court and you win or you lose, but then it really gets down to enforcement. And as your old dad said, might makes right. Now, I know that's completely against the concept of peaceful aloha protest that you mentioned before. I'm sorry, I don't remember the Hawaiian phrase.
Kapu aloha.
Yeah. Now, I would say one thing. The Super Ferry protest actually seemed to work. It was the first time that I saw a mass of people come together on a particular issue. I happened to be there, but we don't need to go into that. But anyway, the Super Ferry left and never came back. So I'm not saying don't do this stuff, but I'm saying do it. But it seems to me you have to have, number one, masses of people. We learned that in the Vietnam era.
Direct action is very important.
By masses of people, because that seems to be the only thing the government listens to. And, you know, be expected to be ready and expect to get beat up, go to jail, you know, whatever you have to do. Personally, I believe in Mahatma Gandhi's principles, and as far as I know, that's the only government that was ever changed by nonviolence. And then what happened? Eventually, somebody shot him. But anyway, that's my two cents. I just wanted to remind everyone that keep going, have a lot of energy, have a lot of enthusiasm, but it's a long, long, long road, and you may end up in a situation just like the Ohana Kauai Initiative did, where you win, but you lose.
That was the Kauai Rising Initiative, and Ohana Kauai was the younger crowd that did the marches, and then, maybe the Ohana Kauai one is more 2491. The ballot initiative was the effort of Kauai Rising, and we did talk about that last night. And definitely.
I'm not sure we're referring to the same thing.
The ballot
this
initiative.
Was organized by Walter Lewis in Princeville.
Okay.
It was a charter amendment change because we couldn't do a ballot initiative because it was a fiscal issue.
Oh, okay. It's a different one, and that probably was Brian then. I thought you were speaking to... Okay, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Anyway, you can research it. It's all there online.
Okay, and tonight, Kilauea, 6 o'clock, if you want to come and share that directly with Paul.
Thanks. Aloha.
Okay, aloha.
What else did you do this week, Felicia?
Okay, so I went to that transportation plan meeting. That was good. I want to tell people it's important. The county budget is going to be up for public comment tomorrow at the county council meeting. We're going to have the county council report soon. County budget is a really, really critical time for people to literally put their 2 cents worth in. And how things are budgeted in the end is very important in whether something happens or not. Tonight at the general store of Hanalei, there is a presentation on the reef damage and the challenges that are happening there.
Well, who's doing that?
I think that is Terry Lilly's group. They're doing that down there. And then, so that's tonight at 6 o'clock. I wanted to point out that what we did learn about was, you know, Earth Justice, they are suing the Agribusiness Development Corporation. There's actually several companies that are working on that because that's just related to the pesticide issue. I wanted to say something kind of positive about our representative election for 14. We have two candidates. Like a lot of times when we're talking about having two candidates that we don't like, we have two candidates that we do like, or I do like. For Derek Kawakami is running for county council. Mm-hmm. He has been our representative for 14, and we have Fern Rosensteel, who is a proactive activist who really has a lot of passion and political will. Mm-hmm. She's somebody who's a change agent. She is very much willing to go in there and push for things that are needed. She's running. She's been in here. She's, I will be honest, she's a good friend of mine. But Nadine Nakamura is also running. I would describe Nadine as competent and capable. Not saying Fern isn't competent or capable, but Nadine has been, she was a county councilman. Right now she is, or county councilwoman, she is the managing director for the county. When people want a county manager, her job position is the closest to what that does. I frankly think she's doing a pretty good job in there. To be a representative is a cut in pay and a little bit of a step down in terms of responsibility and influence. I feel like Nadine is doing a very good job. She's a person who is steady and good at helping make sure that the bills are paid, that everything's running well. She knows a whole lot, so she's running. And then this is on the Democratic ticket. There is a teacher, who's a Trump delegate, actually, a teacher from Kapaa School. I think her name is Sarah or Sally. I'll have to look that one up. But she's running on the Republican ticket. But Fern will be at this event tonight, and Fern has been very activated. She's a quick learner. I have a lot of respect for her, so I'm kind of excited about her scene, but I really want to get Nadine in here too and see why she's, you know, making this choice. You know, it's to me, people have said to me, oh, you should run for that position, you should run for that position. I don't like to get on a plane. I don't want to go to Oahu. I you know, that's not something that holds my attention. But or it holds my attention, but it doesn't. It's not something that I guess that I want to be able to do. But these women, they're willing to go over there. So we have three women running for that office. There might be others. I heard Sandy Kato Klute, another person I like. She worked in the visitor industry, and she is on the board of the Agribusiness Development Corporation. I saw that she pulled her papers, so she might be in there also. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha, yeah. I just wanted to say something. I know you mentioned some of our candidates for District 14, mm-hmm. the House of Representatives seat, yeah.
Yeah.
And what I worry, because I know you guys talking about today, about, you know, looking for change in the state especially, you know, I worry they threw Nadine in there just to compete with Fern because Fern is such an ace. You know, we got one of our best warriors in the seat, so we really got to get her in. And for them to pull Nadine over, her taking the pay cut notes because they need somebody who actually can compete with how amazing Fern is. So I hope everybody can vote for Fern, and hopefully we can see some changes in the state level and across the board. Of course, we're still voting for Gary Hooser and Chalk, you know, all the aces. Yeah. Okay, Mom.
Tell us what you love about Fern. What makes her so amazing? I love Fern, but what are you seeing?
You know, she's
smart.
She's an all-around good player. You know, not only is she a farmer, but you know, she listens to people and she's passionate about what we got going on out here in Kauai. You know, she's born and raised over here like many of us, and you know, she's a part of the Hooties that are, you know, trying to keep Kauai as amazing as it's been, and trying to, you know, the whole Kuleana, you know, trying to keep things amazing and even making them even better for the upcoming generation. Yeah, and Fern's one of those warriors, so hopefully we can get her in. Make sure you guys vote for her. August 13th is election, and what we can start pre-voting as early as, what's that date again?
August 1st, I think.
That's there we go. You know, everybody come out and vote. You know, the more people that come out and vote, the more, you know, it shows we care and we try and forget better and come in together in that form of unity. Yeah.
Yeah. She's got a lot of courage. When I look at her, I feel like, vote for her, so vote for me. Her and I have a whole lot of similar perspectives, but she's taller, younger, and more gnarly. You know, she is very courageous. I feel like I'm courageous too, but she's, I appreciate her. So thank you for, your support for her.
And thank you for your guys' show. Have a good evening. Aloha.
Aloha. And Jazz with John is, coming up. I don't know if, John has anything that he wants to share. He's busy getting his sound together. Kauai Community Radio is coming up with our fun drive next week. This show, we will be doing a fundraiser. I ask all my listeners out there, our listeners out there, if you appreciate what you learn, if you appreciate what happens on this show, if it makes a difference for you, please consider calling in and making a donation. People can pre-donate. We have the silent fund drive. If people are an early donor, they get in the listing for a hotel stay. I'm going to play that because I can't quite remember it. I don't have it right in front of me. But it's really a very, very good gift. And there's all kinds of little gifts that happen. But I know for myself, I put my money where my mouth is. I am a sustaining member and have been for a number of years. Most of the volunteers who come in here, they give every month. They help to make this happen. This is a labor of love. We have almost 90 volunteers who make this happen, and it really is a voice of the people.
And, you know, the fun drive is actually a lot of fun. They're really great shows. We have a good time, and there is food. There's food in the station, and that's actually one way that businesses or individuals can contribute. We were talking about that at the pre-fun drive meeting. If there's anyone that would like to provide food for the volunteers in the studio during the fun drive, that would be great.
Yep, and the Wave Rider, really great way to get your name out there. And the underwriters, these people, you know, you can thank them. Like I see for Jazz with John, he's got Kauai Coffee, Kamoa Ukulele, Tiki and Niki, Kauai Marine, A. Feinberg Galleries. If you go in there, you tell them, hey, I heard about you on Kauai Community Radio, and thank you for bringing jazz, for bringing Hawaiian music, for bringing such a range of information and opportunity to our island. It's really, really excellent. We have all our different public service announcements that go on the air here, and those are free. We do a lot of things for different individuals and organizations that are out there. So I am very, very proud to be a part of Kauai Community Radio.
You know, it is a great thing to be a part of, and there are always volunteer positions to be filled. There's lots that people can get involved with doing here that don't necessarily involve being on the air.
That's right. And also, as Kauai Soapbox, we really reach out for people to come in and share their stories, share their issues, and make it be a part of, they can come on. Like, hey, I'll throw my phone number out there again, 826-7774, if you want something that way. My cell is 652-4363. AkamaiMom@gmail. We care. We can take a call for just a very, very short moment, and then we're going to hear the county council report, and we will be on to Jazz with John. Do we have a caller?
No, Felicia, that was Dove, actually. Oh. He was asking if we can play a spot that's there about hurricanes. Do you see that?
Yeah, I did just play it. Should I play it again, Dove? I mean, maybe we did. That was with Tulsi Gabbard.
Oh, right. Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Give me another shot. He wants to hear it again?
Okay, it had a lot of clicking. Okay, so I am going to play Kauai Listens first, and then I will play that.
KKCR listens to you. Huh. If you'd like to make comments or provide feedback regarding our programming, or to suggest programming you'd like to hear, go to kkcr.org, click on the contact link, and take our listener survey. Or send us a letter at KKCR, P.O. Box 825, Hanalei, Hawaii 96714. Kauai Community Radio, listening to you.
Aloha. I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Here's a county council report for the week of May 9th. There will be a council committee meeting at 8:30 a.m. on Wednesday, May 11th, and a public hearing at that same date at 5 p.m. The meeting and hearing will be in the council chambers in Lihue. Here are highlights from the agenda. The Public Works, Parks, and Recreation Committee has a request from Council Chair Raposo for the Director of Parks and Recreation to provide a briefing on the administration's future plans for the expansion of Black Pot Beach Park in Hanalei. The Housing and Transportation Committee has on their agenda Resolution Number 2016-39, establishing crosswalks, striped pedestrian walkways, and intersection modifications on Makomo Road in the Kaloa District in the county, and a public hearing was held on this on May 4th. The Planning Committee has on their agenda three bills. They are Bill 2609 for an ordinance amending the county code relating to homestays, Bill 2619, Draft 1, for an ordinance amending the county code also related to homestays, and this is restricting homestays to the visitor designation areas, and the County of Kauai is the applicant, and this was deferred from April 13th. Finally, Bill 2627 for an ordinance to amend the county code by adding a new Article 5B relating to the Lihue Planning District in the county, and the County of Kauai is the applicant, and a public hearing was held on this on May 4th. The Budget and Finance Committee has a request from the Director of Finance for agenda time to provide the Council with an update relating to the county's long-term financial plan project contracted with the Government Finance Officers Association. Also, Bill 2610 Draft 1 for an ordinance to establish a general excise and use tax surcharge for the County of Kauai, and this was deferred from April 13th. The Committee of the Whole has on their agenda Resolution Number 2016-42 proposing a charter amendment relating to the institution of a council-manager form of government, and this was referred on May 4th. There will be a non-public executive session. Purpose is for the Office of the County Attorney to brief the Committee of the Whole on matters concerning the impact that statutes and constitutional provisions will have on efforts to change the governmental structure of the county from the current system to a council-manager form of government, and to discuss the opinions issued by the Office of the County Attorney as they relate to this matter. Please note, public hearings are scheduled for 5 p.m. on this day, that's May 11th, Here are the subjects of the public hearings are resolution number 2016-35, establishing the real property tax rates for the fiscal year July 1, 2016 to June 30, 2017 for the county. Bill 2625 for an ordinance relating to the operating budget and financing thereof of the fiscal year for July 1, 2016 to June 30, 2017. And this is the fiscal year operating budget. And finally, Bill 2626 for an ordinance relating to capital improvements and financing thereof for the fiscal year July 1, 2016 to June 30, 2017, and this is the fiscal year CIP budget. For more information on meetings or meeting archives, please visit the county's website. Until next week, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Aloha.
And you are listening to Kauai's Community Radio, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, coming to you from the beautiful island of Kauai. And let's give this a listen.
The following is an important message paid for with official funds by the Office of Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard.
Aloha. We are so fortunate to live in Hawaii, but we have some seasonal disasters that are unique to our islands, and it's important that we are prepared. Hurricane season begins June 1st, so make sure that your ohana has a plan, an emergency kit, and enough food, water, and medicine to last at least 1 week. I've posted a helpful checklist and tips to stay safe at gabbard.house.gov. Mahalo.